This is VOA News, reporting by remote. I'm Joe Ramsey. In a major expansion of gun rights, the U.S. Supreme Court says Americans have a right to carry firearms in public for self-defense, AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The High Court has struck down a New York law requiring people to show a particular need for carrying a gun in order to get a license to do so in public. The justices ruled the law violates the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms.
This decision isn't just reckless, it's reprehensible.
New York Governor Kathy Hochul says it's especially painful after a series of mass shootings. President Biden says he's deeply disappointed. But Tom King with the New York State Rifle and Pistol Association, which brought the suit, has a different reaction.
Relief.
That lawful gun owners in New York will no longer be persecuted by laws he says have nothing to do with safety. The ruling's ultimately expected to let more people carry guns in the nation's biggest cities, with challenges expected to similar laws in a half dozen states. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Afghan villagers rush to bury the dead while others are digging by hand through the rubble of their homes in search of survivors after a powerful earthquake in eastern Afghanistan. The Taliban and the international community that fled their takeover struggled to bring help to the disaster's victims Thursday. State media reported Wednesday's quake killed 1,000 people. But in the first independent count, the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs said around 770 people had been killed. Either grim toll would make the quake Afghanistan's deadliest in two decades, and officials continue to warn the number could still rise. Find more at voanews.com. This is VOA News. European Union leaders are preparing to grant Ukraine candidate status to join the 27-nation bloc, a first step in a long journey toward full membership that could take years to achieve. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Making the war-torn nation a contender now seems to be a done deal after leaders were initially divided on how fast they could move to embrace the bid launched only a few days after Russia launched its invasion on February 24. According to several EU diplomats, Ukraine will receive the unanimous approval that's required for the launch of discussions. Leaders of France, Germany, Italy and Romania have recently visited the country and vowed to back its candidacy. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
In the U.S., public hearings on the January 6, 2021 United States Capitol riot will continue Thursday and into next month, AP correspondent Tim McGuire reports.
Members of the committee investigating the riot by backers of former President Donald Trump plan for additional hearings in July. Committee Chair Mississippi's Benny Thompson says a lot of information has been coming in, including new documentary film footage of Trump's final months in office. The panel is also working on an interview with Virginia Ginny Thomas, a longtime conservative activist married to Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. She's been asked to talk about her communications with Trump's team ahead of and during the day of the insurrection. This month's final hearing is expected to highlight testimony from former Justice Department officials about Trump's proposals to reject the election results. Tim McGuire, Washington.
U.S. health officials are banning Juul e-cigarettes, AP correspondent Shelley Adler reports.
Health officials have ordered vaping company Juul to pull its electronic cigarettes from the U.S. market. It's the biggest blow yet to the embattled company that is widely blamed for sparking a surge in teen vaping. The announcement by the FDA is part of a sweeping regulatory review of e-cigs, which faced little regulation until recently. Since last fall, the FDA had okayed a few e-cigs that account for a very small share of the vaping market. To stay on the shelves, manufacturers must show their products help reduce the harm of smoking for adults without appealing to kids. I'm Shelley Adler.
Recapping our top story, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled Thursday Americans have a right to carry guns in public, a major expansion of gun rights. The court struck down a New York gun law in a ruling expected to directly impact half a dozen other populous states. The decision likely allowing people to legally carry guns on the streets of the nation's largest cities. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey. VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight, for the last 3 days, Mali's army carried out airstrikes against Al-Qaeda-affiliated Masi Katiba jihadists. Also, internally displaced persons in northern Ethiopia, Afar region, have been leaving some camps due to lack of food and shelter. We'll have these stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Supporters of Senegal's opposition banged pots and pans in the capital, Dakar, yesterday evening in the latest protest ahead of legislative elections next month. The protest was organized by the main opposition coalition, Yawi Askan Wi, after its candidate list for the balloting was disqualified. Supporters like Anna Rasul Diop came out to signal their anger at President Macky Sall, saying he should go. The demonstration followed street protests last week that turned violent, with police deploying tear gas and water cannon. Several politicians were arrested, and opposition leader Osman Sonko said 3 people across the country were killed. Tensions have been running high since major protests broke out last year. Many accuse Sall of trying to eliminate his competition after 2 main rivals were jailed on corruption charges in 2015 and 2018. Sall swept to power in 2012 on a wave of popular support. This has long since soured. For the last 3 days, Mali's army carried out airstrikes against Al-Qaeda-affiliated Massina Katiba extremists following the massacre of at least 132 civilians. The strikes, according to the French news agency AFP, were carried out around Bankas and Segui, near where the mass killings took place, and also further afield around Djeni and Tenoko. The army did not provide any assessment of the operations, which no other sources have confirmed. Mali suffered one of its worst civilian killings over the weekend, the latest in an ongoing series of massacres across the Sahel. The Malian army described the killings as a backlash against the strong pressure it says it has put on them in recent months. The UN, France, and other international observers have expressed grave concern about the deteriorating security situation in Mali. Morocco and the U.S. Africa Command are again hosting Africa's largest military exercise, African Lion, which runs till the end of the month. It includes forces from Morocco, the United States, and European Union nations, and will be conducted in 4 countries. In addition to enhancing military preparedness and multinational coordination, African Lion is a powerful demonstration of America's long-standing commitment to partnerships in Africa. David DeRoche, Associate Professor of the Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies, explains to VOA Senior Analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi what's involved in an exercise of this size.
This is really perhaps better understood as a series of exercises that are conducted simultaneously. So you have, you know, in the advance of the exercise, you have significant logistic effort moving troops and equipment into Africa, which, you know, is a worthwhile undertaking in its own right because, you know, it allows people to figure out how they would move on to the African continent, you know, in the event of a natural disaster or, you know, if there's a military conflict. There's a command post exercise that will be conducted in Italy, Germany, as well as in African countries that allows people to exercise their higher level staff procedures to see how armies talk to each other. There's an air exercise, there's a maritime exercise, and then there'll be a parachute drop featuring my former unit and other African countries. So it's pretty significant. It exercises all the domains of modern warfare, and it also enhances interoperability.
What does it accomplish in terms of military readiness and the strengthening of relations between the involved countries?
In terms of strengthening the relations, that's really where you'll see your immediate benefit. Just that countries get used to seeing each other and possibly operating with each other. They learn about strengths and limitations. They learn about things that are easy for partner nations to do and that are difficult for partner nations to do. The other thing is that whenever you exercise something, you find out things, you know, you validate your assumptions. So, for example, if it was assumed that you can move 40,000 tons of cargo through a certain port, and then in preparing for this exercise, you find out that there are limitations on movements because of problems with roads or cranes or docks or whatever, you find those out. And that allows countries to modify their plans and their contingency procedures. So it's a useful exercise.
The world is a very different place this year as compared to last year's African Lion exercise. Russia's invasion of Ukraine has reminded NATO and the whole world about the importance of military preparedness and the need for strong alliances. It has also drawn attention to China's threat to Taiwan and the need for some sort of deterrence. Talk to us about African Lion in light of these developments, and why does the United States devote so much time and effort to African Lion?
First off, you know, the need for deterrence and the threat posed to the national sovereignty of basically every nation in the world by the precedent established by Putin invading Ukraine, that is generally accepted in the West. It is less accepted in Africa. So having these military operations, I think, may help focus our partner countries on the need to maintain a strong conventional military capability, which, you know, has been neglected for the last 20, 30 years. People have had this idea that, oh, it's all guerrilla warfare, counterinsurgency. So that's the first benefit. The second one is, you know, a lot of things happen in Africa. They're not all military, but they usually require military means of dealing with them. So humanitarian disasters, response to emergencies, response to pandemics. When the Ebola outbreak was in West Africa, that was done by the same U.S. forces that are taking part in African Lion, the same army unit. So that enables us to, whether you go there for an exercise or whether you go there to deal with an outbreak of disease, the capabilities required are more or less the same. And then finally, you know, just having senior leaders together is a benefit. You know, people kind of talk about possibilities and, you know, just there's a lot of value to human interaction. And we've lost a lot of that during COVID.
That was David DeRoche, Associate Professor at the Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shenawi. Internally displaced persons in northern Ethiopia's Afar region have been leaving some camps due to lack of food and shelter. The UN has warned that returning home may not prove any better and are calling for more international support. Haliba Tumani reports from Samara, Ethiopia.
Afar region officials say this camp in Dufti, northern Ethiopia, houses about 30,000 internally displaced persons, or IDPs. Many were forced to flee their homes because of fighting between Tigray regional forces and federal troops and their allies. Others fled a record drought that has killed millions of livestock and left millions of Ethiopians facing hunger. Myram Hamad is a mother of three who in January walked for 400 kilometers to reach the camp, only to find it overcrowded and without enough food or shelter. She says, I don't know what's better for us, because even if I return home, no one will support me. She says, we don't get sufficient support here. I don't know what's better for us. She says, I feel more stressed and I'm worried about returning. Myra is not alone. In June alone, Afar disaster officials say at least 8,000 internally displaced persons returned home because of shortages and the closure of one camp. The UN's refugee agency says since March, 12,000 IDPs in the region have returned home. Idris Mohamed Abdallah is a local IDP leader at the Dufti site. He says there is lack of resources. Sometimes it comes in bits. Sometimes we distribute to 300, 400 or 500 households. So it causes conflict for those who don't receive, he says. Russia's war in Ukraine has taken global attention away from Ethiopia and driven up the cost of food aid. The UN's Humanitarian Affairs Office in Ethiopia says it needs $3 billion US dollars to meet IDP needs, and those who return home may be worse off. Michel Saad is the head of the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs for Ethiopia.
Because if they return somewhere where there is no health center, there is no schools, no access to water, water is not running, no electricity, no banking system, no telecommunication, I mean, obviously the situation is remaining very, very difficult.
Meanwhile, IDPs in the camps wait in the scorching heat for help, rationed first to the most vulnerable. Mother of six, Asia Hussein, a displaced mother, is among the lucky ones getting food today. She says, I have six children, and to be honest, this food is not enough. But what shall we do? At the moment, Ethiopians displaced by war and drought have no good options. Halima Athmani for VA News, Semera, Ethiopia.
The World Health Organization, WHO, will be deciding on Friday whether to declare monkeypox a global health emergency. The deliberations and scrutiny of the WHO's response to the outbreak follows concerns over how the UN agency and governments worldwide handled COVID-19 in early 2020. Monkeypox does not spread nearly as easily as COVID, and there are vaccines and treatments available. The case count from the current outbreak outside of Africa has topped 3,000 in more than 40 countries, according to a Reuters tally. There have been no reports of deaths. The viral disease, which causes flu-like symptoms and skin lesions, is endemic in parts of Africa. The continent has registered just over 1,500 suspected cases this year, of which 66 have been fatal. The WHO has said it is working on a mechanism for sharing treatments and vaccines. The emergency committee meeting today includes experts from the most affected regions. They will make a recommendation to WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, who makes the ultimate decision over whether to call the emergency. You're listening to African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. Please note, we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There, you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. Unlike 2021's bumper harvest, critics warn there's a chance that this year's crop won't carry Zimbabwe through to the next farming season. The government has maintained that maize, a key staple, is among the products that are controlled and can only be sold directly to the Grain Marketing Board with incentives to encourage farmers to comply. From Harare, reporter Kuzai Zanawashi has more.
Earlier this month, the government announced that it's illegal to sell maize to private entities and that farmers should take their grain to the Grain Marketing Board, or GMB, which has a mandate. Farmers have complained about the situation. Jenfan Musere is Minister of ICT, Postal and Courier Services. He briefed the media recently after a cabinet meeting.
The nation is also informed that cabinet has approved a review of the price of maize to ensure farmers' viability. The current maize price to 75,000 per metric ton plus a fixed early delivery incentive of $90 per metric ton. The early delivery incentive will also be extended to other crops such as traditional grains, sunflower, and soybeans, and is payable to 31 July 2022. And also, this applies to all deliveries that have been made since the commencement of the marketing season.
Farmer Paul Madindo reflects on the official maize prices.
Actually, it's an insult to the farmers. Government should put in some measures which can save the farming community. If you look at the 75,000 LTGs, if you convert it to US dollars, it's about $120, which means it doesn't make sense for a farmer. We have used some inputs there, fertilizers, chemicals, and some labor as well. So it's not even enough. Maybe they should even peg it at around the $250, maybe to be fair for a farmer than the $120.
Fellow farmer Innocent Mija echoes Madindo's sentiments but applauds other measures.
The $75,000 per ton is too little. It doesn't motivate you to go back into the fields next year. At least government should review the price up to $250 per ton. Though we applaud the $90 early delivery incentive, and we really urge the government to keep this in place for eternity.
The government has begun importing maize from Malawi and Zambia to bolster the nation's supply. Amid growing concerns of looming food insecurity for many, the government has said there is no need to panic, as Zimbabwe has enough maize to last till next year's harvest. The Famine Early Warning Systems Network says the below average and erratic rains in the past season, along with the high cost of living, will hinder food access for many households. For VOA, this is Kudze Zhinawashe from Harare.
The war in Ukraine is reverberating around the globe, sending food and energy costs skyrocketing, with Africa hit particularly hard. Alex Smith is a food and agriculture analyst at the Breakthrough Institute in Berkeley, California. Before the war started, while Russia was threatening Ukraine, Smith wrote an article entitled "A Russia-Ukraine War Could Ripple Across Africa and Asia." Well, a ripple it did, and there is no end in sight. I started by asking Alex to what length the Ukraine conflict has so far affected the African continent.
Ukraine and Russia are both massive producers and exporters of grains and seed oils. Ukraine is the fifth largest exporter of wheat in the world, and Russia is the number one wheat exporter in the world by total volume, at least they were in 2020. Ukraine and Russia are also massive exporters of sunflower oil, corn, safflower oil, different kinds of grains as well, barley and millet, for example. In Africa specifically, there are a number of countries that are extremely dependent on Ukraine and Russia's wheat and sunflower oil exports. Eritrea, for example, is dependent on Russia and Ukraine for about 100% of their wheat consumption, their total wheat supply. Somalia is about 90%, and then countries like Madagascar, Egypt, Namibia, and Tanzania are also massively dependent on Ukraine and Russia for wheat. For similarly, Algeria, Egypt, Sierra Leone, Cote d'Ivoire, and Sudan are also very dependent on Russia and Ukraine for sunflower oil deliveries and supply. So when the war broke out and trade through the Black Sea was halted and has remained halted or at least limited since the war. So it's been 3 months. There are so really the rippling effect is quite large and has been exacerbated by both climate change related drought and heat waves and also COVID and sort of supply chain shocks from COVID. We're still early on in this process. I think there's some concern that this could be a multi-year sort of response. The rippling effect could go on, but I think we still have a long way to go before we sort of know the extent of the crisis, the extent of hunger and food distributors caused by the war, that at least is like sort of tangentially caused by the war.
You just painted a very bleak picture, Alex. Is there any prospect for economic growth?
Like there seems to be limited growth expectations in the next few years, especially in the larger economies like South Africa, Nigeria, and Angola. But the growth rate is staying fairly, it could stay fairly steady from before the war. But as inflation in like the West has become a big part of news, and one piece that's sort of ignored in all of this is that inflation in a lot of countries in Africa is actually worse than in the United States. So, for example, the U.S. in May 2022 saw about an 8.6% inflation rate, whereas countries like Sudan, saw a 245% inflation rate, or that's the projection inflation rate for 2022. Zimbabwe and Ethiopia are also seeing really high inflation, as well as Angola, Ghana, and Nigeria. So it is a bleak picture.
That was Alex Smith, a food and agriculture analyst at the Breakthrough Institute. He talked with me from Berkeley, California. Cameroon's President Paul Biya has, for the first time, sent a delegation to Europe to try to encourage well-off Cameroonians living there to invest back home. But members of Cameroon's diaspora say undemocratic practices and corruption in Biya's government put off investors. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Government officials say a delegation led by Youth Affairs and Civic Education Minister Mununa Futsu was dispatched to Germany this week to ask Cameroonians there to invest in their country of origin. Futsu said his wish is for all Cameroonians in the diaspora to put aside their differences and help develop Cameroon.
The head of state reiterated his call to the Cameroonian diaspora to come and build Cameroon. He sees this opportunity to come and exchange with the whole Cameroon diaspora here in Europe so that we can present the different opportunities offered by the President of the Republic and his government so that the Cameroonian diaspora can come back and participate in the development of the nation.
Futsu said the government will offer tax exemptions of up to 40% for diaspora investments in Cameroon and loans of up to $10,000 with no interest rates for diaspora youths who return to invest in agriculture and livestock. Kennedy Tumenta is a Cameroonian investor who lives in Germany. He says many in the diaspora find it hard to trust promises made by their government. He says corruption, high taxes, and a lack of confidence in President Biya, who has been in power for 40 years, scare investors.
Freedom is restricted and they are afraid to move around in Cameroon and do their businesses and speak freely. Most diasporas believe that the widespread corruption when it concerns opening businesses in the country or the Northwest-Southwest crisis is not being taken into consideration seriously by the government in place. It makes them frustrated, and the only way to express these frustrations is either to withhold their investment in the country or attacking the head of state.
Separatists have been fighting to carve out an independent English-speaking state in mainly French-speaking Cameroon since 2016. The UN says 3,300 people have died in the fighting. Some disgruntled Cameroonians in the diaspora have become hostile to the government, and at least 7 Cameroonian embassies have been attacked or ransacked since January 2020. Felix Mbayu is a top official with Cameroon's Ministry of External Relations. He says Cameroonians taking part in such protests are hurting the country's image.
Those who left Cameroon unhappy and have not been able to make it there are those who would speak ill of Cameroon. Those who left Cameroon to better their lot in life and who have made it there are those who come back to invest in Cameroon. That's why you see medical doctors who have built hospitals, built clinics, bring back home medical supplies. You don't see them in the idle marches abroad. In fact, when you talk ill of your own home, you tarnish your own image.
An estimated 5 million Cameroonians live abroad. The government says the largest diaspora population is in Nigeria, where about 2 million live. There are also high concentrations in Belgium, France, Germany, the United Kingdom, and the United States. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Cedric Franklin, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.